The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we still, to a large extent,
live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
David Auerbach is a freelance columnist and gadfly who has written for publications such as the LA Review of Books, Slate, The American Reader, and many other publications. We discuss his recent blog posts entitled Trump Diaries, as well as the concepts of an underculture and an overculture on this week's podcast. It's Wednesday, May 10th, 2017, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. I want to remind you that Angela Nagle's book, Kill All Normies, is available for pre-order through Amazon, and to let you know that there will be a link to the book, both the UK and US editions, in the show notes at the Zero Books blog. If you enjoy this podcast, you should consider joining the Zero Books Club. The Zero Books Club members receive access to a Saturday podcast entitled Inside Zero Books, which sometimes features the second half of conversations with Zero Squared guests, sometimes features conversations with Zero Books readers about the state of the left, and sometimes features public lectures from the Zero Books authors or staff. Zero Books Club members are also invited to participate in YouTube workshops. Right now, you're listening to some vaporwave from a YouTuber or band called Betamax. It's Take Off. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to David Auerbach and I discuss Trump Diaries. David Auerbach is a sometimes member of what he calls the overculture, a graduate from Yale. He is a former columnist for Slate, a blogger for Reuters, a fellow of the think tank New America, and an author for Pantheon Books, with a book coming out called Illogical Operator next year. His recent Trump Diaries at his own blog, Waggish, prompted this conversation. David, thank you for taking the time to be on the Zero Books podcast.
Thanks for having me.
You were also a software engineer with Microsoft.
I spent some years, 5 years at Microsoft and 5 years at Google. And after I sort of burnt out on that, I switched into my current gadfly writing career.
Did you ever meet Bill Gates?
I never met him, no. I know people who got yelled at by him, though.
Okay. All right.
So, which is more or less anyone who ever met him.
Well, why don't we start there? Why did you decide to become a gadfly writer after you left Microsoft? What was it that motivated that career change, or what was your first topic as a gadfly?
I'd wanted to be a writer all my life, and the economics of it seemed absolutely prohibitive, especially once I had student loans to pay off. And so I enjoyed software engineering, and so it seemed like that was definitely the path to go rather than academia or freelancing. And when things were a bit more stable, I felt that I could either continue the software engineering path, but I didn't quite have the passion for it that the people around me had, or I could try to make a go of it in here. And I tried fiction writing, and eventually Keith Gessen at N+1 was kind enough to give me an opportunity to write about technology there. And that sort of spurred me to wallow around in what I'm doing now and work on the book that I'm doing, which actually talks a bit about my history and sort of the twin paths of humanities and technology that I've gone through and how they're affecting it. And in some ways that infects my outlook on politics as well, which is that the various media, social media and other capabilities that the internet has brought to give voice to people that groups of people that previously did not have a voice is something that I'm very interested in and that I've been able to see from both the inside and the outside. And some of the columns that I wrote spoke to that. There was a point at which Facebook released its statistics on which users were reading what news sources. And I love to be able to dive into that because it really showed how much you were getting sort of right and left bubbles forming in the social media world. And this was 2 years ago, and I guess it's become the story now, but I was happy to have gotten that early peek into it.
Okay. You know, this is going to make me break from my script, but I think this is good. Would you say that your interest in technology and the way you've kind of developed expertise in understanding the demographics involved in social media and the way you can use social media to do demographic analysis, do you think that has shaped how you think about topics or not topics, but categories like the underclass and the overclass?
I think so, because what I learned, especially at Google in particular, because Google was operating with this macro level God's eye perspective on the world where every website was just a tiny bit of data that was getting thrown into this huge index repository of billions of 200 billion web pages. It pushed me towards a more statistical view. You know, if you're looking at this phenomenon, you can look at it from an ideological stance, you can look at it from an economic stance, but there's also this underlying statistical stance of, okay, how is information being propagated? Who is seeing it? And how does that affect the various movements of, say, voting patterns in this country? You know, this is something that actually the book spends a lot of time on, which is how to join, you know, the everyday human agent or quasi agent in, you know, a global world with this view that I sort of had, that I was able to take a part of looking down and treating, you know, all the websites and all the people as the world as sort of ants.
I was looking at a trillion pieces of data a month. Trillion pieces of data a month. Trillion pieces of. I was looking at a trillion. I was looking at a trillion pieces of data a month across this network that was connected to, at times, over 8 billion connections in a system that was only 700 million people at the time. Trillion pieces of data a month. So we had a really good snapshot of what was happening. And as the business model grew for Facebook, trillion pieces of data a month, it was dial it down, weekly. And people started screaming, but you bait and switched me. You told me to make content. I bought, you know, I went out there and I put money into your system to gain followers, to gain fans. You know, it wasn't just celebrities. It was companies like the New York Times or, you know, companies like yourselves or companies to gain followers, to gain fans, you know, that wanted to reach an audience and build a base. And then suddenly Facebook said, well, you know, I understand that this is a trillion pieces of data a month, based on a trusted system between you and your consumer, and that consumer subscribed to you because they really want to hear from you, but we're the business in between now.
You've been writing these Trump diary entries on your blog. I guess you're on the 9th one now, and that's one that got my attention, but I'm going to go out on a limb. I don't think I've read them all, but I've read a few of them, that this division between the overclass and the underclass informs a lot of your writing on Trump. And that, so my question would be, if you're looking at this from the point of view of a Facebook data analyst, can you differentiate between the ants and tell who's a member of the overclass or an underclass? Or does the overclass even show up online? I mean, go ahead.
I wanted to say it more as over culture and under culture, because I fear that calling them classes is a little misleading.
Yeah, that's my bias. I'm sure. That's my Marxism, like, imposing itself on you. You weren't talking that way.
Here I am being scared that, you know, the second I say class, all the Marxists are going to jump on me and say that I, you know, obviously I have no idea. I was actually speaking to a friend the other night who was saying that Gramsci had the perfect model for what I am talking about. And if only I were smarter, I would see that. And I was saying, I'm not yet ready to take this one size fits all model and apply it. But you were asking, to what extent can these people be identified? Well, there's one easy way to identify them, which is the blue check mark on Twitter. And I mean, I say that a bit in jest, but not entirely, because I think that, you know, that institutional imprimatur is a sign of belonging to, you know, a sort of respectable, safe, accountable public national class. You know, when, what was it that they took away from Milo Yiannopoulos when they first really wanted to start to get rid of him? They took away his blue check mark by saying, you are not one of us. And I don't know exactly what algorithms they have, but, you know, the blue check mark, I think, does elevate you, and it probably turns off certain filters on your content so that you don't accidentally get caught in the broader filters that might get you in trouble if you say, quote, Trump's words literally and trigger some, you know, profanity filter or sexism filter.
Right.
So that's one indicator, but you can also look at it from the perspective of, okay, who's connected to who? You know, Facebook has tremendous amounts of demographic data on all of its users. And if you wanted to divide people up in that way, you could. They have much finer grained divisions in terms of, okay, who belongs to such and such. But if you wanted to get some of these broader classifications, such as, okay, who lives along the DC Northeast corridor and commutes from New York to DC and does that sort of thing, you're going to get at least some approximation of, you know, one elite component of what I call the overculture. So there's certainly ways to isolate them. And I think that I meant my terms to be somewhat loose, but I hope that people will recognize them and say, and be able to say with some degree of certainty, that this person is definitely an overculture resident, whereas this person is definitely not.
If you are a university professor in New York City, are you automatically part of the overculture at that point, or can you be still part of the underculture?
Certainly some of my friends who are professors here, I would not say belong to the overculture. Okay. I think it's especially in universities that you do get some sort of marginal cases, because you have these people who are considerably more tapped into, you know, national discourses and things like that, but who actually have no actual power because they're spending all their time doing theory in ivory towers and just trying to earn enough money to live in New York or wherever it is that they live. So I think that it's a marginal case, but someone like Stanley Greenblatt, the famous Harvard theorist who apparently earns something like $400,000 a year, is definitely overculture. A professor who gets interviewed, you know, on television a lot, someone like Richard Posner, is definitely overculture. Someone who teaches at City College or Brooklyn Tech is probably not.
Recently, like during the campaign, I actually reached out to former National Endowment of the Arts director Bill Ivey after he got published by WikiLeaks. And interviewed him. And I was actually a little intimidated, because even though I'd interviewed people on the left who had some esteem, I felt like I was getting close to the halls of power, you know, that I was.
Right.
I was interviewing someone from the overculture. I mean, I wasn't thinking in those terms. And what I found during the conversation was, when he would agree with me, especially about left politics, like at one point he said, yeah, I'm kind of a Marxist too. I felt like, you don't get to say that. Don't say that. Because I become uncomfortable when some of the ideas that are important to me as a rebel are taken up and embraced by the overculture. And I feel like the left right now the radical left is in danger of being smothered by the overculture.
It's a curious relationship. I think that in some ways, the what happened on the right is a good template to look at, because it was a bit clearer in that, due to the greater bifurcation of the, you know, Republican leadership and sort of the Republican base, they had to have these emissaries to the underculture that voted for them. And these emissaries were people like Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and Michael Savage. And there's this tension because a lot of these people are people you would not want to let into the overculture proper. And someone like Rush Limbaugh knew that, and he knew his place. Someone like Chuck Johnson did not know that. And so when he started going after Alan West, for example, Chuck Johnson being the got news person, when he started going after Alan West and started just making all sorts of trouble, it was very clear that whatever purpose he had served to the right overculture was at an end, and he was going to be persona non grata after that. And you're seeing that happen with a lot of these alt-right figures now, except they didn't even get as far as Chuck Johnson did because they made their sort of instabilities known a lot earlier, and their in the case of someone like Richard Spitzer, their unacceptable allegiances.
Right. Now, Richard Spitzer will never be embraced by the overculture. I mean, at least I hope not. It would, you know, it would be a massive change to the overculture if that were to happen.
Yes. Well, you saw, I think that there was some bleeding, you know, when Michael Flynn Jr. was retweeting Mike Cernovich, that was a more porous boundary. And I think you saw that happening because of Bannon's place in the administration, that Breitbart acted as a semi-permeable membrane for right underculture groups in a way that, you know, Fox News did not. Fox News kept a much tighter lid on things. And talk radio was always much more I talk, you listen. So it didn't allow the percolation of the hoi polloi. But especially last year, you saw, you know, genuine grassroots or whatever groups popping up, to the extent that the Reddit, the Donald, was actually the main online congregating place for Donald Trump supporters, even though it had stuff that Fox and even Breitbart wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole. And that really happened on the left. The left is a different and more confusing story, but I think that having that as a reference point makes it easier to look at the left and say, okay, what sort of things have they been trying? The left hasn't sought out as much political involvement from its underculture groupings. I think they've sought more to use them purely as public relations fodder.
Okay. So are these – here's my trouble with the overculture, underculture story. It's that I wonder to what extent you are – spinning a conspiracy theory here, because it almost sounds like there are people in the overculture who make conscious decisions about that's not what you're saying.
No, it's an organic thing. I mean, you know, we've all seen The Wire because we're all lefties. Institutions protect themselves, otherwise they die and stop being institutions. So, for example, when Chuck Johnson crossed a bunch of lines, doxed whoever went after Alan West, there was a general consensus view that, oh, wow, this guy has become a problem. It doesn't take coordination to then take that and say, well, okay, let's start ignoring this person. There may be some diktats from, you know, I don't know, like I could see Roger Ailes sending out a message saying, like, don't invite Chuck Johnson on. But there's no, you know, there's no meetings in a star chamber to decide who gets ostracized and who doesn't. It's much more of an organic thing, that there are trends that ebb and flow, and there's ways to sort of see why they ebb and flow. In the wake of Trump's loss, for example, in the wake of Trump's win,
our loss, his win.
I just slipped into another, into an alternate universe that's not a joke, I guess. I've been saying that we clearly have forked off into one of these parallel universes that constitutes the joke branch of the multiverse.
Right. The night that Trump won, I put a little video clip from the television show Community about the darkest timeline.
Yes.
You know, so that's, we are in the darkest timeline.
This is the darkest, most terrible timeline.
Enough with the timeline crap, Abed. Pierce got shot in the leg and died. Shirley's a drunk. Annie's locked in a mental ward because her guilt drove her insane. Jeff lost an arm in the fire. Troy lost his larynx because for some dumb reason he tried to destroy a flaming troll doll by eating it.
Clearly you don't understand anything about defeating trolls.
And actually, we could go, I mean, like the whole Bernstein effect meme seems to have resonance right now with people, I think, because they like to fantasize that maybe we're in the wrong universe. He won in this universe.
Go. Yeah. In the wake of that, there's clearly been a reassessment, especially among left-wing outlets, of, okay, who should we be giving attention to and what sort of rhetoric should we? This hasn't been any sort of coordinated action, but, you know, if you look at media circles, they're tight. They talk to each other. There are Facebook groups that they all belong to. And there were certainly stories that were coming out over the past few years that were clearly being distributed through certain Facebook groups that reporters, journalists, bloggers all belong to. But that's not – no one was giving orders. It was just they all saw the same thing. They had the same input. And likewise, why is it that, you know, when someone gets shot at a Milo Yiannopoulos event in Seattle in January, that doesn't get covered at all? It's because no one in this sort of media bubble saw that.
And they just didn't see it at all, right? It's not like
but it's not a conspiracy. There's no conspiracy. I mean, no conspiracy beyond the fact that there's a hierarchical power structure in this country, as there is everywhere, and that causes certain tendencies. And the history of the world is basically the history of governments having power sharing agreements with a small elite class so that the remainder of the entire country or nation or whatever doesn't cause too much trouble.
But now it's got this digital layer over it. I mean, you said something really interesting. So it was the reason that the shooting in Seattle at the Milo event wasn't covered, it was because no one saw it, even though it was reported, right?
It was reported locally, yeah.
It was reported locally, but it didn't get into the national press, and it didn't get into, most importantly, into any kind of Twitter hashtag or, you know, wasn't going viral on Facebook or on YouTube because it just never popped up in the influencers' news feeds.
Yeah, I that would seem to be the reason, I would guess, yeah.
And if we could understand how things end up in those influencers' news feeds, like if I can understand that, I would be very happy because that would mean I could probably sell more books maybe. But is that part of the overculture as well, is that if you are someone who has enough followers on Twitter and are an influencer – that you're probably a member of the overculture?
Not necessarily. In some ways, Twitter did offer people the chance to do an end run around that. And I think that social media in general made things more porous and is part of the reason why this has become a problem. For example, Milo Yiannopoulos had lots and lots of followers, but he did not have the sorts of followers that made you an overculture member. quite the opposite.
Yeah.
So it's a matter of being in the right circles. And that applies on social media. It also applies off of social media, that if you can talk to people in person and get stories shunted through the Washington Post or the New York Times, that's going to have much more of an effect. Why did the Fyre Festival generate so much press? It was because clearly enough people at the Fyre Festival knew people who were connected to this.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that was an overculture story. The people from mm-hmm. the overculture were the ones having to eat soggy bologna out in some tent rather than having a, you know, paradise
right.
vacation.
And that's the sort of thing that leftist overculture in particular loves, because it's like, look at us. We can, you know, make fun of some of our own denizens.
Right.
Because it's not as cool to be elite as it used to be. So there's a lot of pretense about rebel chic or what have you.
You know, my perspective generally tends to be sort of a vulgar Marxist. I mean, this is something I've come to lately, like since 2008, since the financial crisis. I've become interested in like reading. I read Capital Volume 1. I've read some Hegel. I'm what I call a wannabe Marxist at this point in my life. So this story that we're talking about now is really, it's a cultural story. It talks about how people, it's like how stories are shared, what ideas are shared, what kinds of notions come into the, you know, into general acceptance, who But all those things will have economic effects, because if you're promoted by the overculture, you might get a job. You might get a venue. It also seems to be very much media focused. It's like, who gets to talk, who gets to be heard.
Right.
And so this is just what you're talking about is only one aspect of the overall culture and of our politics and economics, right? I mean, this is not the only thing driving our politics, but it's there.
Oh, certainly. Yeah. I think that, and there's an economic component to it too, that I haven't spoken to, which is that a lot of the promotion of certain underculture memes and what have you was done as an economic strategy, specifically to sort of to produce more content, clickbait and analysis and things like that. So in some ways you could the left-leaning media made something of a deal with the devil in terms of trying to use the underculture as a content farm, but they tried to co-opt it in ways that didn't completely get it under their control. And I think that you're now seeing an increasing pushback saying, well, we don't want these other cultures to have a say, right, to be boosted by our voice, because they're uncontrollable and they get us into trouble and they harass and they're Bernie bros and whatever.
Okay. So do you think the Bernie Sanders rise had something to do with these decisions that were made by websites like BuzzFeed to promote social justice as a way to get revenue?
Well, I think the promotion of social justice like stories had begun before that. I think you had said there was a sort of a radical chic that was coming into being around 2014 or so. Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the big events there was probably Black Lives Matter. That was something that, you know, had a lot of resonance among a lot of people. And there were organic movements forming down on the ground, and there were protest movements. Ferguson was a big thing. And it came in a very ready-made form for media outlets that wanted to use these things to get views. And, you know, I'm sure they thought they were doing good, and I'm not going to indict them for being craven or whatever. It's more that it was the happy coincidence of, okay, here's a bunch of progressive stories and causes that we can market and make money off of. And, you know, when Comcast or Time Warner or whoever invests in BuzzFeed and Vox, they're taking a part of it too. They're making that calculation rather coldly, saying this is the sort of business that we want to get involved in. The problem is that the content business, I call it the clickbait business for short, which may be a little unfair, but I mean, I think everybody knows what you mean. That what I mean when I say that you know, the stories that are expected to go viral, to say everybody says, look at this progressive outrage, please share it with a billion other people and then go to our site. That model was seen to be a huge success, primarily because I think of BuzzFeed. BuzzFeed was definitely one of the biggest successes there, Vox as well. And it hasn't worked out. They've missed their revenue targets, and content is no longer seen as a viable growth strategy, at least not for the numbers that those companies were valued. And that's also having a big effect, because there's no longer the economic incentive to promote these stories, combined with the fact that there's clearly that people – there's an increased sense of political liability around those stories, and you're seeing radical chic in the more overculture outlets go quickly into decline. You can see this – do you remember Emmett Renson? He worked for Vox, and he got suspended after he – what did he – let me see if I can find it. Renson did write The Smug Style in American Liberalism. That's probably what he's most famous for, but that's not what got him in trouble. This was in the middle of 2016. Vox said, on Thursday night, Emmett Renson, deputy editor of Vox's first person section, sent a series of tweets that urged people to riot if Donald Trump comes to their town. We at Vox do not take institutional positions, but direct encouragement of riots crosses a line between expressing a contrary opinion and directly encouraging dangerous illegal activity. We welcome a variety of viewpoints, but we do not condone writing that could put others in danger. Emmett's tweets violated Vox's standards, and Emmett has been suspended as a consequence. Now, this is pretty ironic coming from the same outlet that wrote you know, riots are scary, but can also have positive social consequences a year earlier. You know, the message I take from a story like that is, well, when we said that, we didn't mean you to take it seriously. And it seems like even some of their own employees took it seriously. But that when push came to shove, no, we are not in the business of advocating anything in the way of revolution.
I mean, look, clearly that position, riots can sometimes have beneficial social consequences. All it means is, you know, after the fact, from your ivory tower, you can decide whether you're going to upvote or downvote the riot, and you should probably upvote it. It doesn't mean
that's a good analogy.
So right now I'm heading down to Berkeley, California. There's a big protest planned today. You got Trump supporters on one side, you got anti-fascists on the other side. People are fighting in the street, violence. It's crazy. But luckily, I recently watched a Pepsi ad where Kendall Jenner uses Pepsi to basically heal the rift in our great nation. So before I get to the protest, I'm going to stop by Target real quick, pick up a couple 12 racks, and we're going to see if we can heal this divide.
If you're a 20-something and you are outraged and you start writing about this stuff, it's not surprising that you're going to come to the conclusion that, well, our political mechanisms are totally broken and writing this stuff isn't enough to affect change.
Right.
It's just that, you know, if you're a 20-something making a very poor salary, you're employed by the overculture, but you aren't quite yet a part of it. You haven't ascended to pundit status in the way that, say, you know, Bret Stephens of the New York Times has. So there's that misunderstanding. And if you misunderstand, you're going to get kicked out. You're not going to be allowed to continue. It's the people who sort of in, and this is what I mean by it's not a conscious conspiracy or something. You're going to be kicked out because that's how the institution polices itself. And so the institution will continue to elevate like-minded people, and so it will preserve a certain ideological consistency and narrowness.
It reminds me, if you know who Peter Rollins is, have you ever heard of him?
Doesn't ring a bell.
Well, he's this sort of postmodern liberal Christian. So he talks about how he used to be part of the evangelical world, you know, faith healers and things like that. And he realized that he didn't – that – the reason he had to leave was because he believed it.
Mm-hmm.
There was an incident. I think I'm getting this right. There was an incident where someone fell and like had a real injury during one of these faith healing sessions. And the minister said, the head guy said, call an ambulance.
Mm-hmm.
And it was that point where Peter Rollins was like, oh, but wait a minute. Why aren't we healing this person? <You know?
laughs> Oh dear.
And there's something similar goes on, I guess, with these, you know, with Vox saying, you know, rioting can be socially good, but you know, when push comes to shove, call an ambulance.
I have a quote from a friend of mine actually that I should read, and I think it really sums it up better than I can. He said, if rioters ever showed up outside Vox's Northwest DC offices, a wealthy area populated by lily white yuppies that DC policing and gentrification has mostly rid of people with darker skin than Kristen Stewart and Robert Pattinson, to run up in Ezra Klein's spot and burn it to the ground, they'd be calling the cops and furiously blogging 50 maps that explain how scared shitless I am, and this graph shows why police aren't carrying heavy enough weapons, and a bunch of people that aren't proportionally represented on the Vox staffing chart showed up outside the offices of bourgeois liberals playing radicals. You'll never believe what happened next, pieces.
Yeah. So, okay. So now let's talk about Trump. We've been kind of avoiding talking about Trump, but this is why I wanted to talk to you. It's because this overclass, underclass story or overculture, underculture, sorry, story, sort of shifts the ground on how I've been thinking about Trump. I've been looking at Trump as a demagogue, you know, some sort of proto-fascist.
Mm-hmm.
And people, friends of mine, have been very frightened about Trump in a way that was visceral. It wasn't just like in the Bush years, people were frightened about Bush, but it was it had a different quality. This was like, you know, I knew some people who really thought because of their writing that they could end up in jail soon, that kind of thing. But do you think that we've overestimated Trump's power, that the overculture is sort of dealing with him, and that we can put some of our fears aside?
It's hard to say. It's really hard to say. I think that you can see that things really changed over the course of February and March, and that there's this urge to normalize him now. I think that we're sort of seesawing between overreacting and underreacting. And David Runciman in his book, The Confidence Trap, says that this is just the normal state of democracy, that you get used to surviving crises, but you also get used to, you know, and having no idea what, learning nothing from crises and having no idea whether, you know, the next crisis is going to be the one that wipes you out. And Trump is one hell of a crisis. So I feel it's almost irresponsible to say, yeah, it's okay to chill out. Nonetheless, my worst fears haven't come true yet. You know, I don't know what it would take to declare martial law, but it does seem that there's at least some entrenched power dynamic that doesn't want that to come about. And it may be purely, you know, to take the Marxist analysis, it may be purely for the reason that people think that it will kill the GDP if you start instituting martial law. I don't know, but there's been a lot of pushback, and the incompetence of people like Steve Bannon and McFarland and Steve Miller certainly makes it harder to pull off the sorts of backbooted thugs that one would fear.
Well, one of the things that I worried about after Trump got elected was that his campaign wouldn't end, that he would continue to hold big rallies, and that he would gain more support and more political capital as these rallies continued, as his popularity continued to rise as he was president. And that just didn't happen. The inauguration fiasco sort of popped that balloon, and he hasn't been able to keep any momentum in terms of becoming a big voice and celebrity. I mean, he's the center of attention, but he doesn't seem to be commanding armies of rabid followers or growing his base.
Yeah, I mean, he clearly wants, I think he wishes he could be doing those rallies. If you look, he seems to be wanting to get out and do them as much as possible. It's just that he actually has other demands on his time now. So I think he's pretty miserable and wishes he were still campaigning, because the business of actually being president is just him being faced with a bunch of stuff he can't control and is miserable about and throws tantrums over.
Why doesn't he just turn that over to, you know, Pence and do that? Why does he have to be the actual president? I'm not.
Well, he doesn't. I think he fears anyone saying, "Oh, Pence is the real president," so he's stuck.
Right.
He's odd. This is something that I wrote in an LA Review of Books article called "Make America Austria Again," about how weird Trump is as a demagogue. And I said, Trump stands out from other demagogues in that he didn't seek political influence from a young age. His overriding concern is not power, but love, or at least attention. For most demagogues, from Julius Caesar to Putin, the love and devotion of the public served to shore up their political power. With Trump, it's the other way around. On a fundamental level, he cannot be compared to any other politician because he simply isn't one. Being a politician requires some conception of bargaining and mutual benefit, which Trump lacks utterly. For Trump, the only acceptable outcome of any transaction is the one where he wins and you get screwed.
Right.
So he's emotionally needy and ideologically vacuous, which is why he can't stick to anything and drops it as soon as it looks like it's not going to be a success. The right-wing populism thing got him a lot of followers and attention. It seems like they bought into it, but it seemed like a blatant con at the time to me, and it seems like that's what it's turned out to be. That doesn't mean he might not do scary things. It's just that those things aren't predictable in the way that they would have been with someone like Mussolini. And perhaps that makes him less dangerous. I guess it does, in that he's not desperate for power to the extent that a lot of demagogues are. But it certainly makes him unpredictable, because who knows what he'll do to try to shore up his sagging ratings. But, you know, he's not someone who likes where he is right now. He's miserable. Everyone in the White House apparently is miserable. everyone in DC seems to be miserable right now.
yeah.
Except actually the only people who seem to be happy are people like Robbie Mook, who I guess have their entrenched sinecures and don't actually have to be bothered with the prospect of governing anytime soon.
How is Mook in any way doing well right now? This is what I really don't get, is how anyone from the Clinton campaign after this is even showing up for parties, let alone being given jobs or, you know, it just seems like you would go into hiding after this. Why isn't that happening?
There's no accountability in the Democratic Party. Ask Zach from the DNC. You know, you read his tweets?
No.
Zach from the DNC was a guy who sort of excoriated Donna Brazile in, I think, December 16th and said that, why don't you resign? And the Perez versus Ellison thing was a big proxy fight for that. That Perez was being backed by the old guard and Ellison was being backed by the grassroots, as well as a couple of people like Schumer, who I think really do want to be back in power. Schumer has a clear vested interest because he wants to be majority leader. But, you know, the more technocratic Dem operatives, I think it matters less to them because they get paid either way.
Right. I guess it makes me think that the Democrats aren't that different from Donald Trump. And, you know, they're not actually that interested in power. That there's something else going on there.
Donald Trump needs attention, and I think that a lot of the Democrats just want to sort of have comfortable Tammany Hall-style lives. You know, you do not – the actions they are taking right now are not necessarily the revitalizing actions that one would expect to see in the wake of this level of a devastating loss. It is annihilating loss at all levels, you know, local, state, and national. So to get back to what you were saying earlier, yeah, Trump's – truly fervent base, you know, is only about a quarter of the population. You have a number of people who voted for him grudgingly. A lot of, you know, a lot of evangelicals or religious right people who simply wanted Gorsuch on the Supreme Court. And there's something I've said, which is that, you know, I wonder if Scalia hadn't died, would Clinton have won? Because there wouldn't have been that urgency. Now, Scalia's death, I think, did mobilize a lot of people to say, no matter what, a Democrat cannot win in November, even if Trump is the cost we have to pay for that. So, yeah, Trump has limits in terms of his approval, but there may be people who will vote for him anyway, simply because the thought of voting for a Democratic president is absolutely unacceptable because things have become so polarized. So. That's the thing. Trump is never going to get love of the level he needs. I don't think he can build that much popular support. Now, is 25% enough? In some countries, it would be. I think it's too geographically spread out here for it to be a problem. And I think in some ways, that's always been America's saving grace. That it's just too big for mass movements of a plurality of the population to cause a huge amount of trouble. Ironically, this is, I think, where the Democratic base can cause more trouble because they tend to be more concentrated in cities. You know, if the Democratic base starts making trouble in cities, that's something that you have to listen to more than if you get, you know, a couple hundred people in small cities nationwide trying to make trouble. And I think you saw this with the reaction to the first travel ban, that the mobilization there was, I think, truly impressive and probably the finest moment of the left this year. That people were on it and they shut it down. And that was certainly what I thought of as the real inflection point or possible tipping point is, you know, is Trump going to keep pushing this? And he didn't. And I do take some solace for that. As far as you have a precedent, that's a nice precedent to have. If he had tried to actually keep pushing the ban it through extra judicial means and just telling Customs and Border Patrol to keep going, that would have, I think, brought some of the fears that you're talking about to light. And so I think it's a good thing he didn't.
Well, I have a friend who, a guy who's on the podcast a lot, named C. Derek Varn, who just would swear up and down that the protests in the airports were not decisive and that it was the judicial reaction that really determined what happened there.
Well, I don't know if you can separate them because, I mean, the protests, what I'm including that in that. The ACLU got out there. Lawyers were going out there. I mean, the protests included lots of lawyers. I'm not disagreeing that, yes, if the ACLU and other lawyers had not gotten involved, it wouldn't have been as effective. So what part of were the protests of that? I don't know. You certainly needed the lawyers. I think the protests probably helped. They judges don't make decisions in a vacuum, but I include the lawyers in that. So I'm not disagreeing with that point.
But after, other than that, though, a lot of what's done Trump the most damage hasn't been coming from the left, but it's been coming from the neoconservative right.
Completely. Trump has not, as far as that's about the only thing the left has to show for itself. Yeah. The Democrats as a force have been pretty much negligible over the last couple of months. It's the internecine battles in the Republican Party that have been causing trouble.
From my perspective, the big interesting battle, and it may have already been decided after the election, was not around Trump and on the Republican side, but it was whether or not that we would see the last of the Clintons. And in other words, you know, would there be a change in the Democratic Party? Bernie Sanders seemed to be the most powerful man in the Democratic Party after Clinton lost. He was all over the news. He's still touring. He's apparently the most popular politician in America right now. And it just seemed to me it would be a natural consequence of this election to lose to a reality TV star and an obvious buffoon and sexual harasser and just outright con man like Trump. To lose to him really should have shaken the whole party. It should have changed a lot. And I thought it would have. But that battle seems to maybe have already concluded. But do you think that there's any hope for the Sanders wing of the Democratic Party to take some control?
I think there's hope. I mean, I think a lot of stuff is going on behind closed doors right now that we're not party to. So I think there are struggles going on. I don't know how it's going to work out. There's clearly a lot of pushback. You know, you have seen a lot of criticism made of Sanders and of Sanders supporters. They're blamed for, you know, Clinton's loss. There's a lot of, I think, desire to ostracize Sanders as a symbol or whatever. And I think on some level, the Democrats realize that won't work, but they're looking for a way to co-opt that mentality without including, you know, quote unquote, dissident elements in the actual party leadership. The overculture treats Sanders a bit akin to how they treat someone like Noam Chomsky, which is someone that is spoken about, but who is not going to be given a voice in the media. Yeah, he's beyond the bounds of the acceptable discourse. And Sanders isn't as out there as Chomsky, but I think the treatment is somewhat similar, that he's not welcome. And a lot of his supporters are not welcome. They're not nice. They don't play the game. They don't go to the same parties. Just the universal, I think, disapproval of Sanders among overculture outlets was, I think, really remarkable. And I experienced some of it firsthand. So I can vouch that supporting Sanders was just something you didn't do.
There's these economic decisions, the decisions to try to use the underculture to make a buck, like through BuzzFeed. And then there's a shift away from that when those strategies fail, basically. In other words, you talked about how, you know, the BuzzFeed model of just getting a lot of views turned out not to be that lucrative because people were ignoring the banner ads, which is something we've known about forever online. Banner ads and online advertising is clearly advertising.
It's a little more complicated than that because BuzzFeed's model wasn't actually based around banner ads, but suffice it to say, it didn't work out.
So, however, they were advertising using BuzzFeed, it wasn't as lucrative as they had hoped. And so now there's a shift towards basically membership sites and paying for the content.
Right.
That's bringing with it a cultural change. You're no longer looking to drive huge amounts of traffic to your site, you're trying to find the right people, the ones who are actually willing to pay for things to go to your site.
That's right.
Do you think that if it were to be still economically viable to just drive huge amounts of people to sites and collect the advertising revenue, that this change towards gated content would still be going on just for the political reasons, just because it was beneficial to hold on to the discourse, to hold on to the frame of American politics, to kind of limit the conversation that way?
Oh, that's a good question. I think you'd see more of a split. I think that a site like The Guardian is trying to stay open, and it's having a very hard time doing that because they're sort of asking for donations and things like that. But I think that you wouldn't see as many sites going to a subscriber model, because going to a subscriber model is hard. It's not an easy thing, and people are doing it out of desperation. And I think that rather than going to a subscriber model per se, they would probably just try to control discourse, because you've seen a lot of open sites shut down their comments. And that's one way to shut out the underculture. You don't need to go to a subscription model in order to police discourse more thoroughly. It's more that they want to give people less opportunities to get voices through that. But you can see this now as far as, a site like Vox, or a site like The Guardian, I think, is trying to sort of shore up its institutional credentials, whereas a site like Mike.com is sort of continuing on the social justice hipster route. And I don't see how Mike is going to survive as a consequence of that unless they get like a lot of investment and end up going the more corporate route.
Right. In other words, going the subscriber route eventually, right?
Probably. I mean, there are sites that will probably survive as free outlets, because they are either subsidized or have some other form of revenue or something like that, or they're partly subscribed, or they can also serve as content farms for larger corporations. Like Time Warner could say, okay, we're going to fund you at a loss so that we can take your content and distribute it on cable as well and distribute it on demand elsewhere. So that basically you're producing content at a loss for your division, but we're going to take it and use it to help make money in much more profitable divisions.
Right. And but, basically we'll take this content, repackage it, and sell it
right
on a subscriber basis.
Autonomous news entities, I think, though, will probably be forced to go to some sort of subscriber model or some other model that has yet to be found feasible.
There was recently a big shakeup at YouTube where all these independent YouTubers were demonetized.
Yeah.
And that seemed to be very overtly kind of a political decision that YouTube was making, but it was also an economic decision. So what do you think of that?
It's a really fascinating phenomenon, and I do not have certainty about the exact motivations. I do think there's a general push to whatever, clean up the web, and this constitutes part of it. But what's determining their exact calculations of who's getting demonetized and why? That's a lot harder for me to say. I'm not sure what Google's plan with YouTube is right now, but the effect seems to be making it more corporate to basically, have the content be acceptable content. It's not necessarily over culture content, but you can browse around on YouTube and you won't run into something that is blatantly unacceptable or that will cause you to freak out and maybe get a story written in the Washington Post about you. Like, for example, did you read about the family that was tortured, that was like playing pranks on their kids and abusing them and putting this up on YouTube for clicks?
No, I missed that story. But
it's pretty horrific. It's pretty horrific. I'm not going to summarize it because I'll get in trouble. I can't think of a way to summarize it that won't get me in trouble. But that this family, the mom and dad would play quote unquote pranks on their kids, like spilling ink on a bed and accusing the kid of doing it, and screaming at the kid until the kid cries, and then saying, "Just kidding, we did it." and then putting that up on YouTube. And they got a bunch of clicks. They did this for a while. And at some point, other people on YouTube noticed it and reacted in horror. And
did their kids get taken away from them and or anything like that?
My knowledge. They're in therapy now, though. They're in therapy now. And they were initially defensive, but they seem to have hired a public relations firm since then to help them out with this public relations nightmare. So yeah. If you work at YouTube, you presumably want a way to prevent stuff like this happening in a more systematic fashion than an anecdotal one. You want to catch this sort of stuff before people come out on it. And in particular, you do not want advertisers complaining.
Right.
And I think that part of the move may be that advertisers have gotten more paranoid about where their ads are appearing. And as a consequence, Google and YouTube are saying, okay, we can't just give people the benefit of the doubt. Anyone who has ads appearing on their channels has got to go through some pretty strict checks and balances.
Right.
And maybe they'll loosen them up later. Maybe they're doing a purge right now. I don't know. But there's definitely some sort of cleanup going on.
The alt-right has made real hay with YouTube. I mean, that's probably the place to go if you want to watch someone rail against social justice warriors. It's also where you can go to find really hateful content that's not as well subscribed. But, you know,
Well, Angela Nagel pointed me to a great one. Angela Nagel, who has that book coming out with you. I forget what Kill All Normies.
Kill All Normies, yeah.
Yeah. She sent me a copy. I was reading it. It's very good. I enjoy it. She's clearly much more of a masochist than I am to be studying stuff.
Right. What did she send you to go see?
Oh, no. Oh, sorry. She sent me to one of the Rebels videos.
Yeah.
Where they talked about how I think racism and anti-Semitism weren't cool on the alt-right. And the comment stream is just 1,000 racist anti-Semitic comments. Right. And that's been downvoted into oblivion.
Yeah. And so see, those people commenting, some of those people have their own channels, you know, and you can go and watch their videos. And it's even worse. And there's this one that's a black Pigeon Speaks that has like 100,000 subscribers, and he's saying things like women shouldn't be allowed to vote. They are the whenever women get political power, it's the downfall of civilization. And
well, that was Peter Thiel, right? He sort of made it cool to say that, I think, some years ago.
But okay, so last question, and this is maybe not too relevant politically, but I just have to know because I'm a science fiction writer. And I wondered if you could explain to me why it is that nerd culture is so dominated by social justice politics.
Science fiction culture specifically or nerd culture more generally?
I would say science fiction and fantasy, genre writing.
So the ideology of this, I think someone needs to write a book about it because I think it is fascinating how social justice rhetoric, which I wrote a large piece on for the American Reader, is so memetically powerful. There's nothing like it that I've seen. It was taken up with such a vigor. And I saw it. It's been in science fiction for a very long time. If you were in science fiction, do you remember Race Fail?
Oh yeah.
Right. That's, do you know how long ago that was? That was almost 10 years ago now.
Yeah, I know.
So this is it's a long standing thing. And the question is,
yeah, I mean, it goes back to Ursula Le Guin in a way. I mean, in the 70s, some of the social justice themes were in her work. And in her work, they're not – I mean, there's some real thoughtful, interesting books that have been written with themes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when we say this is the problem with social justice, that, you know, for a term that originated as a Jesuit evangelical project, it's certainly taken on a number of other meanings since then. But you know, leaving aside the political content, I think what people tend to speak of when they speak of that is a certain sort of rhetoric, a certain sort of posturing, a certain sort of a a certain sort of attack politics that, it wasn't quite as possible to engage in prior to the internet. There was trouble made, but I'm a huge fan of Joanna Russ, who in some ways endeared herself to, I guess, the progressive Le Guinish segment of the science fiction community in the 70s when she wrote The Female Man, and then alienated them completely with her subsequent book, We Who Are About To, which is a fantastic book that basically takes apart lots and lots of right and left dogmas. So Russ was such a troublemaker that she did this, but she certainly would have been ostracized for that book had it been published today. But I certainly give her, as many progressive left-wing credentials as anyone. So yeah. When we talk about it, I talk about it more. I assume we're talking about it more as a particular sort of online discourse.
Right. So why is it that science fiction has been so dominated by this online discourse? I mean, because it does seem to be influencing what's being published today too, and it's developed into wars over the Hugos and the World Fantasy Award.
I mean, I think it has to do with science fiction in some ways, or at least the mainstream of science fiction being taken over by science fiction fans as opposed to science fiction writers. That for a long time, I think the quality of science fiction was boosted because science fiction content was unacceptable in mainstream novels. But that's no longer the case. And so you're getting a lot of, I think, increasing slipstream and things like that. And so a lot of less orthodox work is no longer being published, in trashy paperback covers. So what remains is a much more narrow slice that is, and I don't even mean politically, I mean just in terms of the sort of content that gets published, that there are orthodoxies for science fiction, and the people who come up through science fiction communities now are much more likely to come up through very specific channels, because outside of them, people aren't necessarily being drawn to science fiction genre channels because there are no other outlets, even if you want to write speculative fiction. So I think it's become a more self-preserving monoculture. And as that monoculture had obtained a strong social justice rhetoric presence for a lot of complicated reasons many years ago, that has persisted and grown and has sort of been a self-reinforcing tendency. It's also produced, the dialectical result of people like, he who shall remain unspoken, trying to fight over that and fight over this comparatively small piece of the pie. Someone like Terry Goodkin seems to be still published, who is like appalling. So there certainly seems to be niches for outside of that. It's just that the central community around things like the Hugos, for example, as well as the Nebulas, but especially the Hugos, the fan community is now made up of in many ways, social justice acolytes.
Listen, it was a great conversation. Is there anything you want to say about Trump here at the end before we close this off? Do you think that the big question for me is, can we breathe a sigh of relief, or do we need to rethink our resistance?
Trump has certainly not been neutered, and he certainly remains a threat. But I think from my perspective, the greater threat is the ongoing inefficacy of left, far left, and center left movements in general in this country, and that building those sorts of institutions and movements is going to make much more of a difference than resistance per se to Trump. That I am much more scared about the total absence of any sort of leftist power structures in this country than I am about Trump himself. Positively, Trump gives us a focal point, but it can also serve as a distraction, that you get too busy resisting Trump to actually go out and build anything.